I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. One day after federal investigators detailed mistakes that led to a Philadelphia firefighter dying in the line of duty, Fire Commissioner Adam Teal says he supports all the reforms recommended by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH. Though Teal wonders how many of those reforms the city can afford. WHYY's Dana DeFilippo reports.
NIOSH's report revealed all sorts of things that went wrong the night firefighter Joyce Craig suffocated in a West Oak Lane basement fire, from the late arrival of a backup crew to uncontrolled ventilation to insufficient training for what to do when crew members get trapped inside a building. Teal says fighting fires is a complex business, and it's unfair to waste time on Monday morning quarterbacking.
It's dark, it's raining, it's smoky, it's hot, can't find people. The outcome was tragic.
Still, he says, Joyce Craig's death did drive change in the department. The department updated firefighters' personal safety gear and improved communication at fire scenes by creating a new field incident safety officer position. Other improvements NIOSH recommended will cost money. For example, Teal wants to hire 30 more firefighters and 4 new training officers so all crews will have more time to train. To pay for it, he's asking the city to boost the department's $250 million operating budget by $6.5 million. And some of NIOSH's recommendations, like making sure firefighters maintain visual, verbal, or direct contact while battling blazes, sound good in theory, but Teal says they don't always work in practice.
You can't see anything in a fire. I mean, this is not a television show. The visibility in a typical fire is zero. You can't see, you literally cannot see your hand in front of your face.
Although it's been more than 2 years since Craig became the first female Philadelphia firefighter killed in the line of duty, her loss still stings. Captain Lisa Forrest and Craig went through the fire academy together.
She had no problem of speaking up when she saw something that wasn't right. So she was the game changer.
Even now, Craig continues to be a game changer as the department acts on the lessons learned from her death, Forrest says. I am Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
The family of a Delaware correctional officer who died during a hostage incident, as well as 5 officers taken hostage, have filed a federal lawsuit. Details from WHYY's Zoe Reed.
The plaintiffs seek compensatory and punitive damages, as well as a jury trial following an inmate uprising at the James T. Vaughan Correctional Center in February that left Lieutenant Stephen Floyd dead. Their attorneys allege poor oversight under former governors Jack Markell and Ruth Ann Minner and correction officials led to the deadly standoff. Attorney Tom Neuberger says for 16 years, requests to install more security cameras and hire more staff were denied, even after a counselor was raped at the prison in 2004. Neuberger says instead the state spent $23 million a year on overtime shifts.
This was all the direct fault of 2 governors who were derelict in their duties to protect those who were working within our system to keep us safe.
Attorney Thomas Crumpler says the corrections officers he represents suffer severe PTSD and have been robbed of unalienable rights.
The defendants here, including Governors Markell and Minner, not only failed to secure these rights, but their actions over 16 years have deprived Lieutenant Floyd of his life and deprived his family of their pursuit of happiness. Their actions have deprived the CO, Smith, Wilkinson, Tuxworth, McCall, and Hammond of their liberty, and the injuries they suffered and sustained will permanently affect their pursuit of happiness.
Reverend Christopher Bullock, who leads a coalition advocating prison reform, has been pressing the state to improve living conditions for inmates. He says he believes Delaware politicians haven't done enough. He says he hopes the lawsuit, alongside his advocacy work, will spark action.
The people in the community, family members of those who incarcerate, family members of correction officers, are demanding change. This is beyond politics. This is about people's lives and principles that matter.
Department of Correction Commissioner Perry Phelps says he cannot comment on the lawsuit, but says he's working with Governor Jack Markell and the General Assembly to improve safety and security. The governor's proposed budget already asks for $6.3 million more to address prison conditions. There's an ongoing criminal investigation into the hostage taking. The Department of Correction is launching an internal review, and the governor has called for an independent investigation once that's complete. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
Next month's Democratic primary will see incumbent Philadelphia City Controller Alan Butkovitz defend his position from Rebecca Reinhart, who recently gained an endorsement from former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell. A win would mean a fourth term as the city's elected financial watchdog. WHYY's Dave Davies spoke with Butkovitz about what he considers to be his biggest achievements.
Well, Alan Butkovitz, welcome to Newsworks Tonight. You've been on the job since 2006. You've served three terms. What have you done? Why should voters want you back?
Well, we've turned this controller's office into the lead local government anti-corruption unit. We formed the basic evidence for the federal case against Sheriff John Green, against several charter schools. And we've also taken a deep dive into misspending at the Mayor's Fund for Philadelphia. We have torn the covers off of hard-to-discern the ugly side of city government, the fact that Ellen I wasn't really making the corrections that had been said and that people's lives were at stake. And we've got a very viable, very energetic think tank going, working with universities and hospitals in terms of turning the Philadelphia area into an area that grows specific kinds of jobs because of the demand, the $5 billion a year demand of these institutions.
Take one of these examples of rooting out corruption, misuse, and give us a little detail.
Well, the sheriff's department has had a reputation for many years of being inefficient, and we've done audits of them at different times. And in 2010, they were being particularly intransigent. We battled with the sheriff's office for about a year, trying to get them to give us complete information, give us access. They had an attitude that we don't have to show you anything, that the controller really doesn't have any teeth. It's a courtesy if we let you see any of our documents. At the end of 10 months, we felt we had enough evidence to push for a forensic audit. It's one of those areas where Mayor Nutter and I worked very closely and quickly to get a $650,000 appropriation from council so that we could hire the former federal prosecutor who had put several mafia gangsters away. And he did a document-by-document search. Things were not held in file cabinets. They were in huge boxes. And at a point where we thought we had almost run out of evidence, all the things we thought it wasn't. We had almost run out of ammunition, and he found a document that was a contract that showed double payment for certain services by the outside contractor. And that led to sterner interviews of some of the witnesses and admissions by witnesses, and finally the construction of an over 200-page report outlining about 20 different schemes by which homeowners and citizens were cheated out of tens of millions of dollars. Ultimately, the sheriff's office had to put up about $20 million in escrow so it could be repaid to people who lost money in their homes. And they had to change the attitude that this was nobody's money, therefore they could do anything with it. The federal government took our report. They took 5 years, almost to the statute of limitations, indicted former Sheriff John Green for bribery. They indicted Jim Davis 6 months before that for tax evasion.
Somebody was on his staff, one of his contractors, right?
He was the outside contractor who had the run of the sheriff's office.
A consistent criticism of your opponents has been that you are a Democratic machine politician. You're a Democratic ward leader, and that you're in with the in crowd. One thing that was brought up years ago was that you had established an Office of Community Affairs in the controller's office, taxpayer-funded it, which your campaign treasurer was employed, and other people who were Democratic committee people. And this was seen as a way of making political connections at taxpayers' expense.
Well, there's so many questions in that question. You're going to have to forgive me for taking some time. First of all, I'm one of the reform ward leaders. I mean, a couple of years ago, there was a problem with Manny Morales, who ran for council and ran racist and misogynist posts. I was the one that pushed him off the ticket. I was the guy that pushed Jared Solomon, who's a very young, bright guy, got him elected over a 42-year incumbent. There's always a lot of distress about what might be the set ways of the Democratic organization. So how are you going to get change if you don't have ward leaders who are reform-minded and are open to bringing new blood and young people into the office?
What about the criticism that we don't want a ward leader in an auditing function, that you need to be an independent, squeaky clean, divorced from politics?
If it was possible to do that, that's a great idea. But you know, the genius of James Madison, and I just read this about 2 weeks ago. I don't know who the author was, but they said the genius was that he didn't trust in the virtue of man. He trusted in the balance of powers. He trusted in the fact that you would have a robust competition among people who were advancing their self-interest. And as long as you kept a big thumb of tyranny off the scale, things would work out well. That's why this system, which has existed for over 300 years, is the best in the world. When you have people who self-define as saints and therefore they need not be reviewed, that's the road to tyranny and to corruption. And I'll say Philadelphia has an unfortunate history of lauding one new Messiah after the other, and they generally fall apart. Seth Williams was lauded not long ago as super clean and the Messiah. Well, the truth is, once he was dug in too deeply, they found the problems. It's a human foible. The phrases power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. That's why you need a balance of power. That's why the controller was created to be a powerful counterforce to the mayor.
Alan Butkovitz, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
Philadelphia City Controller Alan Butkovitz speaking with WHYY's Dave Davies. How do you find mentors if your identity doesn't align with the majority of leading people in your field? From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports on an LGBTQ mentorship program for medical students at the University of Pennsylvania.
When Professor Judd Flesh was in med school a decade ago, he decided not to come out to his professors. He even lifted mention of membership in LGBTQ campus groups on his resume. Fast forward to now, and he's an openly gay mentor to an LGBTQ med student. Although the world has changed a lot in that last decade, Flesh says some professions are still catching up.
Medicine, I think, has been a little bit slower to respond. It's always been a bit of a conservative profession.
And some specialties are seen as less LGBTQ-friendly than others, he says. The mentorship program formally launched this academic year. It aims to make networking easier and make LGBTQ doctors more visible, says second-year student Sean Udell. He cold emailed Flesh before the program ever existed to ask if they could have a networking coffee.
It was awkward, just sort of sending the initial email like, hey, I heard you were gay. There's no way to say that in a way that doesn't sound terribly awkward.
But the new program gives the process structure and makes it accessible, which is important because Udell says networking and getting good opportunities are just easier for those from what he calls dominant backgrounds. In other words, straight, white, and cis male.
They intrinsically have the ability to network and receive mentorship because the people in leadership that are visible are most often people who look like them and who have their background.
For the most part, Udell says he and his mentor talk about the realities of med school, but occasionally he does reach out to LGBTQ professors about unique instances of discrimination that other students don't experience. Flesh says that's just a reality and that he hears similar worries as an openly gay professor students talk to.
How am I going to be perceived as I move forward in my career? Am I going to be, you know, is medicine still a conservative profession? Are there specialties I shouldn't apply to? Can I go into orthopedics if I'm gay, you know, which is characteristically like this very masculine profession?
Flesh says he sees his role as providing reassurance, but also smart guidance. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
Last December, Akbar Hussein wrote a commentary for the Philadelphia Inquirer condemning hate crimes against Muslims and offering to sit down with anyone who wanted to meet a Muslim and learn about Islam. His friends were nervous about him making such a public statement and providing his email address in a piece that would be online for anyone to see. But he knew he needed to step up and try to be part of a solution.
To date, I've received over 300 messages from people who want to take me up on my offer. So far, I've had 42 wonderful coffee dates, and I plan on making the rest of them happen soon. My article also led to over a dozen speaking engagements about growing up as a Muslim in the United States. As an immigrant, a brown man, and someone who grew up in a low-income community, I'm truly blown away by the opportunity to make my voice heard. While our national leaders restrict travel from Muslim-majority countries and talk about building border walls, my coffee dates have shown that everyday Americans are on a very different page. Through my conversations, I met a compassionate and inclusive America, the very America my parents envisioned when they packed their bags 16 years ago in search of a better life. I met immigrants from all over the world who reminded me that we had been here before. I met an Irish Catholic woman who explained that my story was once her family's story when they first immigrated in the early 1990s. I met with an Asian American man who reminded me about the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 and the Japanese internment camps of 1942. I met with a number of Jewish Americans who reminded me of Henry Ford's anti-Semitic campaign in the early 1920s, and who told me stories about the discrimination of their ancestors faced when they first arrived from Europe. I also met people who had honest questions about Islam and terrorism. Part of my mission was to meet people who are harboring fears and who have real and important questions about Islam that they're afraid to ask. In everyone I met, I saw the diversity and unity of the real America. One of my first coffee dates was with an Iraqi Muslim refugee woman and a Jewish businessman from New Jersey. They write peace poetry together and travel on the weekends to visit libraries, community centers, and schools to discuss peace and tolerance. The woman helped translate the man's poems into Arabic and arranged for their publication in Gaza. This collaboration is the true America. The America I saw was also one of religious diversity, united towards a common cause. I met with leaders of various synagogues, mosques, and affiliated organizations who relayed the same message of solidarity and hope. The America my parents envisioned, the true America, is still alive and is reflected through the responses I continue to receive each day. It is the America where the Jewish mother brings a Muslim student challah to stand in solidarity. It is the America where the Baptist man brings a Quran and a Bible to our coffee date so that he can learn more about his misconceptions. It is the America where we can admit our faults, reflect on our mistakes, and move forward with thoughtful perseverance. It's not going to be easy. Aside from the 300-plus who accepted my invitation, I also received a small number of responses from people accusing me of trying to proselytize people. I have no intention of doing that, but I do plan to respond to ignorance with love. I remain optimistic as I watch citizens protesting against anti-immigrant policies. I remain proud of my community as I meet for coffee with conservatives who have a desire to learn. And I remain confident in our judiciary as they defend the very fabric of our Constitution. The challenge ahead of us is to decipher our America. You and I get to write the next chapter on what we tell the next generation about this time in our country. I want to tell them about the America I saw. What story will you tell? I am Akbar Hussain.
Hussain came to the United States from Bangladesh and grew up in Norristown. He's currently a fellow at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. The Museum of the American Revolution opens tomorrow near Independence Mall in Philadelphia. And WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports it does not shy away from the messy infighting that launched the nation.
The centerpiece attraction of the Museum of the American Revolution is the field tent used by General George Washington to strategize the fight. The tent is erected in a sealed glass box onto which the museum projects a short film narrated by actor Peter Coyote.
Washington prepares the army and himself, knowing this war could be a long one. After I have once got into a tent, he vows, I shall not soon quit it. He keeps his promise.
The war would last 8 years. Much of that time, the British had the upper hand. At one of the many preview events ramping up to the public opening of the museum, former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell said the fight for independence was difficult, sometimes with the expectation that it would fail.
You can't be an American and watch that film and not be struck by how fragile the revolution was. How many times Washington, we have a letter that he wrote saying that if something doesn't happen, this army will soon have to dissolve or disperse. We're at the end of our tether, he wrote it another time.
The Museum of the American Revolution is not a victory lap of patriotic heroism, although there is plenty of that. The Vice President of Exhibitions, Scott Stevenson, tells the story from a wide perspective, from African-American slaves, from women on the home front, from Native Americans, from foot soldiers, And all of these people had second thoughts about whether the revolution was a good idea.
Probably for much of the last two centuries or more, when you said founders or founding generation, the image that came to your mind was probably a John Trumbull painting, right? It was a group of men in Independence Hall who were the people who founded the nation. But, you know, that's not the vision we have of the founding generation now. I think people are hungry for a broader story that talks about the revolutionary generation writ large.
Take, for example, 1775, when the British staged an aggressive attack on Boston. It was a moment that militias from all the colonies mobilized into a unified resistance. The museum's chief historian, Philip Mead, says this was also the moment Americans realized they didn't much like each other.
This is the first time that a large community of the nation has gathered in one place, this military organization. And they thought they could identify as people of the same nation, and then they looked at each other and they said, well, I'm not really so sure. You dress odd, you say strange things, you have a very weird accent.
The museum has a life-size diorama of a snowball fight between militia soldiers from New England and Pennsylvania, which escalated to an ice fight, and then rocks, and then fisticuffs. George Washington personally stepped in to stop his soldiers from attacking each other. The curators of this museum admit that the American Revolution is a tough nut to crack because the story is more than about battlegrounds and troop movements. It's about a class of wealthy landowning men who rebelled over an ideal and their challenge of rallying the young nation around that ideal. We can point to the famous shot heard round the world and the Siege of Yorktown, but Philip Mead, the curator, says those were not really the beginning and end of the revolution.
The American Revolution is something that is sort of trans-historical. It's not just a identifiable historical change in time. It is that, but it is also this idea.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.